From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
In Iraq, more evidence of growing disorder, and what about Latin America? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. In Baghdad today, what may be the largest mass kidnapping since the U.S. invasion, 150 people abducted from a government agency. Meantime, the U.N. reports that 100,000 refugees are fleeing the country every month. Who are they? Where are they going? Also today, Latin America, a low priority for the U.S. since the Reagan administration. Sandinista leader Daniel Ortega has been re-elected president of Nicaragua. Does he represent the growth of leftist anti-Americanism? Is the School for the Americas the right way for the U.S. to re-engage with its neighbors south of the border? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Marvin Ali, back with To the Point. Venezuela's Hugo Chavez is more critical of the U.S. than Osama bin Laden. Now Ronald Reagan's old nemesis Daniel Ortega has regained power in Nicaragua. Today we'll talk about the left south of the border, and we'll hear the difference between carnivorous and vegetarian leftists. Also on To the Point, 100,000 Iraqis are fleeing the country every month. What does that mean for local stability? First, this news update. In Baghdad today, between 100 and 150 men were kidnapped from four floors of the Ministry of Higher Education and Scientific Research. Women were separated and locked in a room. The men then were taken away in SUVs. Nancy Youssef is Baghdad bureau chief for the McClatchy News Service. Nancy, thanks for joining us. Where is this building, and was it under guard?
The building is in Qarada, which is in central Baghdad. It's a mostly Shia neighborhood. It's on the outskirts of that neighborhood. It's close to the area where the members of the Olympic Committee were kidnapped earlier this summer. And they had guards. They had Iraqi guards. But as one of the guards reported to the ministry, he asked these men, what are you doing here? And they immediately kicked him and threw him to the ground. And the guards were, in fact, among the men who were kidnapped. And so they proved that they could not sort of fend off the attackers who came to the building and said, we're members of the Integrity Committee, let us in. So the guards were there, but they weren't enough. The Minister of Higher Education complained that none of the higher education institutions have enough guards, and that this is a product of that.
Nancy Youssef again on a cell phone from Baghdad, bureau chief there for the McClatchy newspapers. Apparently they went very carefully from floor to floor looking at different people. They picked up some and not others. Is that right? They seem to have certain people in their sights, but not all of them.
Well, the minister says that all men were picked up, that they went through floor by floor. This is a four-story building. They just grabbed every man on those floors. They put the women in a separate room. But tonight, so far, 13 have been released. A lot of people suspect that this is a sectarian attack, so it will be interesting to see what we can find out about those 13 released. If it's one sect or another, then we can call it sectarian violence. If not, it's potentially an attack on the government forces and a message to the government that they cannot control this country.
How were the men dressed who came and conducted these kidnappings?
Well, that's a really good question. They were wearing police commando uniforms. Now, that would seem to suggest that they're government forces, but you can buy these uniforms anywhere. They're everywhere, and they're very easy to get. What made people more suspicious is that they pulled up with 20 police cars. You know, as one sitting parliamentarian said, it's one thing to wear a uniform, but where did the 20 police cars come from? And so it really fueled speculation that this was orchestrated by the mostly Shia police force and that they were targeting Sunnis. And perhaps because this building, the ministry is run by a Sunni, perhaps just as a crime of opportunity to really sort of battle it out on the streets, to continue the sectarian battle on the streets.
Has there been a response from the government?
Well, Duad Bolani, who's the Minister of Interior, he fired his commander in the Qarada, his police commander in the Qarada district, and they promised that they will get to the bottom of this. the Sunni politicians are really angry. They see this as a sectarian attack by government forces, and it really puts into jeopardy Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's efforts to gain more control over the government forces from the Americans. If they're this sectarian, what will happen when some call a sectarian prime minister is in charge of them? So the Shiite government leaders are trying to show that they're going to take this seriously and arrest whoever's involved, whether it's a police officer or not. And the Sunnis are skeptical. This has become sort of a political football in this ongoing battle over what the government should look like and who should, how much voice should Shia and Sunnis have in it.
Is it significant that the Ministry of Higher Education and Scientific Research is run by Sunnis?
Well, this is part of the effort to include Sunnis in the government. The idea being that, from the Shia perspective, if we give Sunnis a voice in the government and we give them certain ministries and we give them power, that perhaps the insurgency will weaken. That really hasn't panned out. So this is really part of the distribution package that happened after the election. So a certain percentage went to Sunnis, a certain percentage went to Shia, and a certain percentage went to Kurds. Before, it was run by this ministry. It was run by a Kurdish minister under Ibrahim Jaafari's ministership. So I'm not sure that it's significant. We'll have to wait and see. I think ultimately it was more than likely a crime of opportunity, a way to have a very high-profile attack and send a message, either a sectarian one or one of the government's not in control, to the public and to the government.
Nancy Youssef, a Baghdad bureau chief for the McClatchy Newspapers, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Little breakup there. Obviously, what she is saying is that this seems there may well be a sectarian incident and an effort to demonstrate that the government does not, in fact, have control. We're going to be talking about that more in just a few minutes. Later on, we'll talk about politics and poverty in Latin America on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Mormon Ali back with To the Point. Once again, 150 people kidnapped from a government building today in Iraq by men dressed as police commandos and wearing driving police commando cars. Much concern, as we just heard from Nancy Youssef, the Baghdad bureau chief for the McClatchy News Service, that this may have been an effort to make another sectarian statement to the people in charge of the building being Sunnis and to demonstrate to the government that it is not in charge. The United Nations, meantime, is reporting that some 100,000 people are now leaving the country every month. There also is a great deal of displacement of Iraqis within the country. Dana Graber is Internal Displaced Persons Monitoring Officer for the International Organization for Migration. Dana Graber, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
What does this mean, internal displacement? What's going on?
Well, what is happening is that a lot of Iraqis are experiencing direct threats, abductions, assassinations, and there's just a fear of the general violence. And so many Iraqis have been leaving their place of residence and fleeing to other communities. Usually the communities to where they flee are more homogenous, both ethnically and religiously speaking. And that is where they're trying to settle, and they are tending to move in with relatives or family or direct family or with friends, or they're renting homes, or some of them must even be in tents or go into abandoned buildings.
So obviously that depends on what resources they're able to call upon. Is this a form of ethnic cleansing?
The International Organization for Migration isn't focusing on exactly, politically speaking, what we would call this, or even religiously speaking, but it does seem that Shias are tending to flee to more Shia-dominated areas in the south, and Sunnis are fleeing to the more Sunni-dominated areas in the center.
So there are then refugees within the country, I take it. You said some of them are living in tents if they can't rent buildings or find places to live with their relatives or friends. What sort of conditions are they living under?
Well, a lot of the homes that they rent, first of all, a lot of them leave behind their source of employment, so they do not have the money to cover the rent, definitely not in the long term. And then also a lot of these locations that they're renting do not have basic facilities. They do not have water, electricity, basic sanitation facilities. And if they're moving in with family or friends, oftentimes these places are already very crowded, and so it makes the living situation even more difficult.
Is there any way to estimate how many displaced persons there are within Iraq?
Well, the International Organization for Migration has been interviewing and assessing the displaced populations, and right now we have assessed over 240,000 individuals. The number could be higher, but this is the number that we've assessed at this point.
Again, Dana Graber is Internal Displaced Persons Monitoring Officer for the International Organization for Migration. She's speaking to us today from Amman, Jordan. Once again, the United Nations has estimated that 100,000 people a month are leaving the country. Tim Irwin is spokesman for the UN Refugee Agency. He's based in Washington, works for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. And Tim Irwin, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Where are these people going when they leave Iraq? And can you tell us who they are in the first place? Is it all social classes that are moving? Is it just people who have the money to get out? Or how would you break it down?
Well, I mean, it's done in stages. As you can imagine, those people who had the money to get out were amongst the first to leave. Those people without resources would stay. But now we're seeing that even those groups are fleeing the country. In terms of where they're going, it's pretty evenly divided between those who are moving internally, and they become what we define as internally displaced persons. And we estimate that there are about 1.6 million Iraqis who are displaced within their own country, and there are nearly another 2 million who are displaced outside. Now, many of these were people who left Iraq prior to the fall of Saddam Hussein, but clearly the numbers of people and the rate of displacement has increased alarmingly, particularly just over the last 8 months of this year.
So you do then have a larger estimate than we heard earlier from the International Organization for Migration. What can you tell us about the people that are living internally as refugees within the country?
Well, similar to what your previous interviewee was saying, that many people, fortunately, have been able to find shelter and accommodation with relatives and friends. But our experience is that also there are considerable numbers of people who are living in temporary shelters. These may be unoccupied public buildings, but in many cases they are makeshift camps and sort of unorganized settlements. So clearly these are the groups which are in the most need. And as you can imagine, for organizations such as ours, and given the security situation, it's extremely difficult to make sure that these people are reached.
What about the people who leave the country? What conditions do they find themselves in?
Well, several hundred thousand, about 700,000, have left for Jordan, and slightly less, about 600,000, are now residing in Syria. And we feel that both governments have been very generous towards the displaced Iraqis up until now. And our hope and expectation is that they will continue to show their that sort of generosity to honor international agreements and to provide refuge to these refugees. In terms of how they are living, again, we're hoping that, we understand that many of them have found shelter with friends and family, but clearly there are a number of refugee settlements which have sprung up. And as I say, those numbers are continuing. We estimate that 1,000 people a day, 1,000 Iraqis a day are crossing into Jordan, and twice that figure are crossing into Syria.
Tim Irwin, again, a spokesperson for the UN Refugee Agency. I'll come back to him and to Dana Graber in a moment. First, I want to introduce Peter Candela. He is an Iraqi who's now a general practitioner in London. I should have said Dr. Peter Candela. He's also a medical writer for Lancet and other publications. Dr. Candela, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
What can you tell us about what's referred to as the brain drain in Iraq or from Iraq, particularly from the medical profession?
Well, it is a very serious problem. And in the past, since the trouble started in 2003, people concentrated mainly on the number of soldiers killed, number of people killed, but they ignored the what I call the collateral damage to the war, which has resulted in enormous numbers of professional people, not only doctors, dentists, graduates, postgraduates who are leaving the country, simply because of the emergence of lawlessness. There is no effective government in Iraq. Don't listen to what various governments tell you, the U.S. government or the British government, that there is a parliament and there is a government and an army. Iraq has no government whatsoever. In any area, militias, local groups control the law and order situation. This has led over the past few years to the emergence of gangs who are kidnapping for money, gangs who are basically, no one knows in some cases why they are murdering professionals, because the medical profession in Iraq now is literally depleted. I give you an example. A very close relative of mine recently needed a simple cataract operation, and he had to make the 1,000-kilometer journey from Baghdad to Jordan to have that operation. In the past, in the same country, i.e. Iraq, people used to come from Turkey, from Yemen, from neighboring countries to have transplant surgery. That is all gone because most of the professionals are frightened and they are running literally for their life.
You said professionals in addition to those who are medical people. Is Iraq then seeing a drain of the kind of people who could, in fact, and have in the past, run the institutions of society?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think it is, in some way, if you are a skeptic, you begin to think that there is a concerted effort to deplete the country of its educated classes and of people who spent years and years learning and serving their society. Because if we go in, to recent history, Iraq used to be a home for many Arabs coming there for education, not only medical education, but engineering, simply because it was an open country in terms of education, in the sense that Arabs coming from neighboring countries used to get totally free education. So who wouldn't come? Now, Iraqi doctors, Iraqi engineers, pharmacists, etc., find themselves begging for jobs in countries like Syria and Jordan, who are oversaturated by people who are fleeing the country. And only yesterday, because I have been working on a report on this issue, only yesterday I heard from a group of professionals who landed in Jordan and they were refused entry into Jordan and they were sent back to Iraq. This is very, very, very serious.
Peter Candela, once again, doctor, general practitioner in London, formerly from Iraq. Back to Tim Irwin with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. You said that so far Jordan and Syria had been extremely generous with Iraqi refugees. How long do you think that's going to last?
Well, I mean, we're hoping that it will continue until there is some longer-term solution to the displacement problem. One of the obstacles, of course, which we face is just in financing. The security situation makes our work very difficult, but the humanitarian relief efforts within Iraq itself are woefully underfunded, and that applies to UNHCR as well. So we're facing two big barriers here. One is the security situation, and one is the lack of international funding to address the humanitarian issue on the ground.
Dana Graber, let me go back to you with the International Organization for Migration. You're the Internal Displaced Persons Monitoring Officer. What about the kind of money that obviously will be necessary to try to take care of the people who are internally displaced?
Well, there certainly is not enough funding right now that is going to be meeting the basic needs, especially for IOM, as we are providing emergency humanitarian assistance in the food, in the form of food and non-food items such as blankets and hygiene kits and mattresses and water. However, there's just not enough funding that's coming through to assist these displaced. And I should also clarify the numbers issue, because IOM also estimates that in the past 3 or 4 decades, there have been 1.5 million displaced in Iraq, especially during the Saddam regime. However, it's the spike in displacement since the February bombing of the Shia shrine that is so alarming, and that spike of displacement. We're looking at thousands that have been displaced just since February.
So that's the 240,000 that you were talking about earlier.
Correct, but in Iraq, Iraq suffers from displacement. It has for decades, and that's where we're talking about figures of 1.5 million.
Let me ask you, Dana Graber, the United States has spent a considerable amount of money on reconstruction. We've talked about a lot about that in this country. Is there American money going to help the people who are internally displaced?
Absolutely. In fact, the majority of our funding for the emergency distributions is coming from the United States, but that is quickly running out, and we are making appeals. Right now, we've made an appeal for $20 million to help these people who've recently been displaced.
And Dr. Candela, back to you in London, again, our Iraqi doctor. Final comment, if you will. We don't have a lot of time left. What's the consequence, do you think, of what you've referred to as the brain drain from Iraq?
Well, it is going to be disastrous because Iraq has suffered from the brain drain for a long time, since the Iran-Iraq war. But things started to improve. And sadly, after the U.S. and British invasion of Iraq in 2003, many doctors who were displaced in the past thought of going back to help the build of their country. But the unfortunate thing, many of these doctors, in fact the vast majority, went back as businessmen, as contractors, as they started companies, construction companies. They did not go back as doctors. And when the going became difficult, they came back to where they originally fled to, i.e. Britain or parts of Germany and or other parts of Europe. It is very, very bleak, because when things settle down, and they will settle down maybe in 5 or 6 decades, and I mean decades, the country will be totally depleted of its professionals, and they will have to start from zero.
And you mean not just the medical professionals, but also the lawyers, the bureaucrats, the people who keep government going and once again keep the institutions of society operating.
Absolutely. I'm not only talking about doctors. I'm talking about, yes, people who run the country, the engineers, the pharmacists, the dentists. It is a very sad state of affairs. You just have to be there. You have to talk to the people. I come across transplant surgeons in Jordan sitting in cafes, passing the time when they could be working, helping people. And simply because they cannot work because of licensing problems, different countries have different licensing laws, and their talents are wasted. And these people, one day or the other, they will get fed up and they will say, well, enough is enough. I'm retiring from medical practice.
Well, Dr. Peter Candela, now in London, thank you very much for joining us. Thanks also to Tim Irwin with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees and Dana Graber with the Internal Organization for International Organization for Migration. In a moment, we'll be talking about anti-Americanism and the left in Latin America with on To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. In the 1980s, Ronald Reagan's administration helped finance the Nicaraguan-Contras in their bloody civil war against the radical leftist Daniel Ortega. Ortega, who had ousted American-backed dictator dictator Anastasio Somoza was backed by the Soviet Union. Finally, Reagan had to admit that the money to fund the Contras came from an arms deal with Iran. In 1990, Ortega was voted out, and he's been trying to win re-election ever since. This year, Iran-Contra figure Oliver North campaigned against Ortega in Nicaragua, and the Bush administration backed his opponent. But Ortega won. Some see his victory as evidence that leftist anti-Americanism is growing stronger south of the border. Alvaro Vargas Llosa is director of the Center on Global Prosperity at the Independent Institute in Oakland. He's author of Liberty for Latin America. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You have in the past warned that leftist anti-Americanism is a real threat once again in Latin America, but you don't seem to feel that way about the re-election of Mr. Ortega. Why not?
Well, in general, I would say it's a threat, but it's a threat that's coming from a very, very few number of, very small number of countries right now. And most of these left-wing governments in Latin America, Brazil, Uruguay, even Argentina, Peru, etc., are not radical anti-American left-wing governments. They're sort of social democratic, pretty much in the European mode. So I think it's important to make that distinction. In the case of Nicaragua, there's no question that Ortega's roots are firmly anti-American, and he is, at least by heart, somebody a lot closer to Chavez in Venezuela than, say, to President Lula in Brazil. However, I think there are a number of constraints that could help turn him into somebody, what I call the vegetarian left rather than the carnivore left, sort of a social democratic kind of left. And the main constraint, of course, is the fact that two-thirds of the country do not want to go back to the 1980s style of government that Ortega presided over, which was, of course, very undemocratic, very authoritarian, and very corrupt. They distributed all the properties that they nationalized among themselves when they left power in 1990. So I think there are some important constraints here, and you also have to take into account, of course, the fact that Nicaragua does not have the oil resources that Chavez and Venezuela have at their disposal, which means that they will need investment from various sources in order to keep up a minimum of economic viability. And therefore, I think Ortega will have so many constraints on him that he will be careful not to tread beyond a certain limit.
Alvaro Vargas Llosa, we will be back to you in a moment. Again, director of the Center on Global Prosperity at the Independent Institute. Timothy Charles Brown is now a research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. During the Reagan administration, he was senior liaison to the Nicaraguan Democratic Resistance, in other words, the Contras. Timothy Charles Brown, good to have you with us.
Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Daniel Ortega, to follow up on what Mr. Vargas Llosa just said, has apparently made efforts to seek talks with Washington, and the current Bush administration, even though it opposed him, seems to be at least open to that idea. Does that surprise you?
Not particularly. You have to look at the numbers a little bit to understand. Ortega lost with received 46% loss in 2001. Received only 38% approximately, but won this year, and that may sound odd, but it's because the rules of the game were changed between 2001 and 2006. So he really is not as popular as he was even 5 years ago. He knows that. He also knows that the Cold War is over. It ended when the Berlin Wall fell. And so the international situation is different now than it was when I was involved in the Contra movement. And as a consequence, he faces a different set of concerns, as do we. There's been another change. For example, remittances from the United States have become extremely important to Nicaragua, as to so many other countries in Latin America. He has to recognize that. And finally, if you believe that people can really have conversion, certainly he said he has had a conversion. I think we are taking a bit of a wait-and-see attitude. Let's see what he says and does now and in the future, rather than exclusively dwelling on what he did in the past. The past obviously sets some very narrow parameters and creates a lot of concerns. I've talked to a lot of people who simply don't believe he's changed his stripes. But Washington, I think, quite wisely has taken a wait-and-see attitude, given not just his statements during the campaign, but given his statements after he was elected.
Again, Timothy Charles Brown was with the Reagan administration and was the senior liaison to the Democratic resistance, the Contras. Why was Ortega, why was Nicaragua seen as a threat at that time, so much so that it was worth putting money into the Contras, the resistance that tried to overturn him?
Well, let me correct slightly one of your comments. Sure. I was a career diplomat for 27 years. And I was with whichever administration was elected by the American people. In that case, yes, it was the Reagan administration, but I was there as a professional.
Okay.
It's important to understand that during that period, we were involved in the Cold War. We're talking the late 1970s, early 1980s, so that U.S. interests were different. Most people don't talk about it much, but from my background, what people seemed to be most concerned with was that Nicaragua not become another Cuba, not meaning a communist country, meaning a place where the East Bloc, particularly the Soviet Union, could, for example, station Bear D, Bear F aircraft, anti-submarine and electronic intercept, have its Blue Water Navy come in and have a base closer to the Panama Canal than we had at the time. So those were the background concerns. I've always suspected, although no one ever told me, that had it not been for the Sandinista administration insisting on acting as though it were a lie and a lie of our enemy during a time which we saw as a potential major strategic threat to the United States, our reaction would have been different. And we got along with some Marxist governments better than others, and I think it was largely because of how they acted. The Nicaraguans, actually against the advice I've heard of even Fidel Castro, insisted on aligning themselves with our enemy in wartime, and we reacted accordingly. Incidentally, our contacts with the Contras, although it's not widely known, started before Reagan was president.
All right, Timothy Charles Brown, again, making the point that he served as a professional diplomat, a career diplomat. He was, during the Reagan administration, liaison to the Nicaraguan Democratic Resistance. Peter Hakim is president of the Inter-American Dialogue. That's a think tank for policy analysis and exchange focusing on Latin America. Peter Hakim, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
There has been now, by the Bush administration, apparently in part because of concern over growing leftism in the Latin American countries, a waiver granted to countries that weren't allowed to participate in what's called the School for the Americas because they had not agreed to indemnify or immunize, I guess I should say, American soldiers from their legal systems. The waiver now means that they can come and become involved in the School for the Americas. What's the history of that institution, and why is it important that it's been, to some extent, I guess, revivified?
Well, the first thing, let me say that I don't think it's in any way a response to any concern about the left. This, I think, more generally speaking, that the notion that somehow our military-to-military relations ought to be abrogated because a country has supported the International Criminal Court makes no sense whatsoever. And I think there was lots of opposition right from the outset, and that's now been changed, and it makes all the sense in the world that we can maintain military support, we can train Latin American militaries, we can have exercises with them, etc., without this extraneous element. As far as the school goes, I think that, sure, during a period when lots of countries were ruled by military forces, when armies were in charge, it's not surprising that a lot of people that went through our training programs ended up in senior positions. That was part of a very unhappy history in Latin America primarily, but the United States didn't always help. That period is gone. It's finished. There's no more military rule in Latin America. It's not going to come back. I think that we've seen a real democratic wave. If there's anything that the elections, the dozen elections or so over the past year in Latin America have shown, is the degree to which really democratic processes are the only ways people can assume power. So I think that to sort of talk about the school and talk about the history of the school without putting it in the context of the changing nature of Latin America and our relations is just a mistake.
The school, of course, at various times took a lot of heat and was accused of training people to go and commit human rights abuses in Central and South America. You're suggesting that whatever happened is history, and it's a very different situation.
I'm not saying it was a very pleasant history, but the fact is that Latin America is democratic now. The United States is not supporting military governments as it once did, and the school's history is really not terribly relevant to what's going on now.
All right. Let me introduce one more guest, and we'll go back and have a round robin with all of our guests. Hector Tobar is Mexico City bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. He reported on Nicaragua's presidential election from Managua, and he has covered all of Latin America at one time or another. Hector, always good to have you on our program.
And thanks for having me, Warren.
Tell us, from your standpoint as a journalist trying to cover South America, that enormous place, South and Central America, how is the United States viewed now? And is there, as Mr. Vargas Llosa suggested at the outset, a kind of a difference between the vegetarian leftists and the carnivorous leftists? We'll use his analogy for the moment.
Well, yes, I think that there's a groundswell of resistance and opposition to the economic policies of the 1990s and the first years of the century, economic policies that emphasized the power of the market to transform society and that suggested that the best way for a country to grow and become a democratic place was to embrace the market and all the things that would bring. That has produced a lot of important changes in Latin American society. It's much easier to go to an ATM and get money. It's easier to get a new phone installed. The economies are more efficient, but they're also a little bit more ruthless, and the gaps between rich and poor have increased. And that the discontent with those changes have fostered many different kinds of political movements and have helped the careers of many different kinds of political leaders. You have someone like President Lula in Brazil, who comes from a leftist movement with deep traditions in the Marxist left, but also in the trade union movement, which has a very rich intellectual tradition. And then you have somebody like Hugo Chavez, who leads a movement. Hugo Chavez used to be a paratrooper, and he's led a military coup, and leads a movement that is really more nationalistic than it is leftist, that's more, embraces this idea of Latin American nationalism. And you have a Daniel Ortega, who comes from a Marxist movement, but in recent years has made a series of alliances with Roman Catholic groups, with conservative groups, who signed an alliance with ex-Contras a few months before the election. So this discontent that really is something that is universal, I would say, from the Rio Grande to Tierra del Fuego in the south, has taken many, many different political forms in all the different countries of Latin America.
Again, Hector Tobar is Mexico City bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Back to Timothy Charles Brown, career diplomat formerly involved with the Contras. Are you surprised that Daniel Ortega has made an alliance with some of the former Contras? Some of them are actually a part of his administration. Is that a sign for you of the extraordinary changes that have taken place? Is it a positive one?
Well, the truth is that the major veterans groups of former Contras, the Northern Front and the Mosquitos, both supported the liberal candidacy of Monte Alegre and not Ortega. And the last I've heard is they're quite unhappy. There are, of course, a handful of people who were within the Contra movement in the past militarily who did join him, as they did others, but they are a minority, and in the case of the two I know best, are not representative of the major political attitudes of the former resistance fighters. That is different from the former political activists, such as Jaime Morales, who is the vice president, now elect under Ortega. But the reality was that Jaime, whom I know very well, was not particularly active in the Contra movement at all, although he was on their side. As a matter of fact, he was a supporter of the Sandinistas up to 1979. So to say that the Contras are supported Ortega is to grossly overstate the realities on the ground.
Okay. But he, however, has at least tried to reach out to them, has he? Or is that simply a token effort, do you think?
I don't think he's paid much attention, frankly, to the ones who fought. You have to remember that there was not one Nicaraguan democratic resistance.
Right.
There were five armed forces, two of them fairly large, the others smaller, and then there were civilian political movements. And subsequent to the war itself, from 1990 on, one of the biggest complaints of those who fought were, as so often happens in other countries, those who were mostly interested in politics then promptly forgot the veterans and went and did their own thing.
Timothy Charles Brown, again, now at the Hoover Institution. Alvaro Vargas Llosa, let me come back to you at the Center on Global Prosperity at the Independent Institute. Let's broaden this out and tell us more about this distinction between vegetarians and carnivores. As you phrased it, you have warned about the carnivores from time to time, but you now indicated earlier you think they're a relatively small problem. So what should the United States be focusing on, then, in a general way when it comes to South and Central America?
Well, that's just one of many possible ways of describing what's happening in Latin America. But I think the really important point here is not to look at this as one monolithic and unified left-wing movement sweeping through Latin America, because if we do that, if we fall into that kind of simplistic attitude, then the next question is, well, how do we react? And then we will tend to react, and when I say we, I really mean people in the United States, in a sort of paranoid way, and that will lead to, I think, the kinds of policies we really need to avoid. It's important to distinguish between different left-wing movements for many reasons. One is the fact that there are some real distinctions to be made. There is no question that some of these moderate left-wing leaders, particularly in South America, perhaps now in Nicaragua, although of course that remains to be seen, but certainly in some of these South American countries, in what we call the Mercosur countries, the countries that form the South American common market, certainly leaders who call themselves men of the left, but who also have come to terms with certain realities, the reality being, of course, that the market is a much better allocator of resources than the government, that foreign investment is absolutely necessary in order to create the economic conditions that will in turn allow these leaders to deliver on some of their promises to the poor, that globalization is a force that they will have to come to terms with in one way or another. It's not something that you can simply wish away. And many of these leaders have therefore preserved many of the reforms that were undertaken by center-right governments in the 1990s, many reforms that they themselves back then were dead set against, but which they now understand were part of a necessary process of realigning many of our institutions and our economies. So what happens now? Well, what happens now, I think, is really important. I think part of the problem is that some of these left-wing, moderate left-wing governments are too dependent on the current and very positive international conditions. I'm talking basically about the high price of many of the commodities that these governments, these nations export. And so because they are getting a lot of revenue from these exports, they are avoiding the types of reforms that they would need to undertake in order to make Latin America more competitive, as competitive, say, as India, China, some of these rising Asian nations. But for the moment, they are at least avoiding the mistakes of the old left, and I think that's a very important improvement, because if Latin America is going to become developed, it will need to have a broad political consensus spanning the center left to the center right, and that will in turn create conditions of stability that we really need. So I think it's important to make a distinction between this type of left-wing movement and of course, the Chavez loony left that unfortunately is still alive and kicking. And I think, and I finish with this, the United States needs to engage these leaders and these people. And I think, to be fair to the United States, it has been trying to do that in the last few years.
Okay, Alvaro Vargas Llosa, we're going to take a very brief break. Then I want to come back and ask Hector Tobar a question, the Mexico City Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. You said there's a good deal of resistance, a kind of groundswell, because of some of the reforms that Mr. Vargas Llosa was just talking about. The question would be, how long will people be patient before there's real trouble in Latin America? We'll be right back with To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to podcast this program, visit kcrw.com and click on KCRW A to Z.
Warman Ali back with To the Point, to talk again about Latin America. Probably, as it's been pointed out, we've bitten off more than we can chew. An enormous area, very diverse. Ridiculous to talk about it as if it was just simply one entity. But we can make some generalizations. And Hector Tobar, let me go back to you, Mexico Bureau, City Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times, on this issue of the kinds of economic reforms that have been made, the new moderate leftist governments that are trying to live with them. How long is that going to last, as you indicated earlier, with the gap between the rich and the poor increasing?
Well, I think that in many of the countries in Latin America, you're seeing more of a class-based politics. You're seeing many leaders step forward who are gaining followers because of their charismatic resistance to neoliberalism or globalization. There's a term I first heard in Mexico about the anti-globalization movement, the globofóbicos, the globophobes, and their numbers are definitely increasing. I think the hope is that this discontent will lead to new political movements that will sort of fill the vacuum in many of these societies between right and left. But there's also a real danger of that discontent creating populist and demagogic movements like we've seen in many of the countries in Latin America.
What about Mexico, where you are now, where the opposition candidate who lost the election insists that he, in fact, won and that he won't recognize the winner when that person takes office?
Right, exactly. Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the former mayor of Mexico City, the candidate you're talking about, we have to remember won about 38% of the vote here in Mexico, almost the same total, just a fraction of a percentage point less than Felipe Calderón. And Andrés Manuel López Obrador is talking about forming a parallel government. He's going to have his own inauguration in a couple of weeks. It's going to be a mass event here in Mexico City. Now, a lot of people here in Mexico laugh at Andrés Manuel López Obrador, thinking that he's coming off as a loony, as someone on the fringes, who's gone from the mainstream to the fringes of Mexican political life. But I think that what he's betting on, and what a lot of people on the left in Latin America are betting on, is that as economic crisis continues here and as poverty continues unabated, that the solution that looks a little bit more radical might look better down the line to most Mexicans or to most Latin Americans. And I think there's definitely an increased polarization of political life as a result of the increased poverty here.
So, Peter Hickam, back to you, president of the Inter-American Dialogue. What ought to be the terms of the dialogue, and what can and should the United States be doing, particularly with regard to Mexico, but toward other countries in Latin America as well?
Well, I'm absolutely stunned that our previous the correspondent from the L.A. Times would suggest somehow there's equal credibility, there's equal stature of the government that was elected and authorized by law, and Manuel López Obrador, who is essentially trying to get power through street demonstrations. And this is rather remarkable. I think what we're witnessing in Latin America is...
I think he was talking about how he is viewed by Mexicans rather than how he's viewed by Hector Tobar, but go ahead.
Well, no, it sounded to me very clear that there was a certain parallelism, symmetry, that really doesn't exist. One person won by the rules and the other person lost and is unwilling to accept it. And that's been the problem for Latin America for a long time. There's people that aren't willing. It used to be the military. And now you're having people like López Obrador who aren't willing to play by the rules. And if he is and he can win elections, that's terrific. That's just what Ortega did in Nicaragua. And the reason Ortega won in Nicaragua was because previous governments have been awful in Nicaragua. They've left the country impoverished. In Mexico, on contrary, actually things are getting better in Mexico. And there was a serious there's a serious group of people who are still poor and unhappy, and that's why the election was so close. In those countries where governments have been good, there's been re-elections. Uribe in Colombia from the right, Lula in Brazil from the left. In Chile, a left-wing government was sustained in power. Clearly, people are voting just the way we vote in the United States. When a government isn't doing its job, when it's leaving problems unsolved, it's going to be pushed out.
So, Hector Tobar, is Obrador then really threatening the democratic stability of Mexico?
Oh, I would say that there are many people who believe that he is. My point, the point that I was trying to make, was not to comment on who the legitimate president of Mexico is. I think there's no question that Felipe Calderon is. But I think that there are millions of Mexicans who feel left out by the current economic model. They feel left out of the political process. They believed deeply in Andrés Manuel López Obrador as a leader of a movement who would bring them to the political table. Many of them, millions, feel that they were cheated. That doesn't make them right. It states a political reality. And I think the situation is inherently unstable, and that if Mexico doesn't begin to show better economic growth than it has in the past decade, that we are sitting atop a potential cauldron here of social and class conflict. I have absolutely no doubt about that. We might not like that reality, but it's definitely the Mexican reality that I see.
Okay, we're going to have to stop there. Really an indication, I think, of how little we talk about this whole region so close to us, so important, and yet so often ignored. We'll talk about it in the future, and I hope all of you will be back so that we can get further wisdom from you. Today's program produced by Vanessa Romo with Katie Cooper and Christian Bordahl. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.